Currently, Representative Cummings is a member of several influential congressional committees and has used that relationship to advocate for and advance policies to improve the health of those less fortunate in our society. Among those issues for which he is passionate and has played a leadership role is men's health and, in particular, prostate cancer. Congressman Cummings has been a strong supporter of the National Institutes of Health and, in particular, the National Center on Minority Health and Health Disparities. Now, bear in mind that as a member of the Committee on Oversight and Reform, this committee has investigatory jurisdiction over any federal program. Most recently, Congressman Cummings played a leading role in a congressional inquiry about an adolescent who died in Maryland as a result of complications due to inadequate dental care. Now, he may speak about this case in his address, but let me say that his determination to ensure that no child ever again would die from a preventable health problem has led to the creation of programs to meet this need, including the introduction of legislation to include guaranteed dental benefits in the Children's Health Insurance Program, which we refer to as the CHIP program. When the 111th Congress convenes in 2009, Representative Cummings will continue to be a champion on health. Depending on committee reassignments, he may have an opportunity to impact in some new ways how our nation provides solutions to the elimination of health disparities. One thing I know is that Elijah Cummings will continue to be at the forefront, supporting our efforts for medical breakthroughs and to produce the world's best and first-class biomedical researchers. It is with great pleasure that I ask you to welcome the Honorable Elijah Cummings.
Good afternoon, everyone. No. You can do better than that. Good afternoon, everyone. It is certainly my honor to be here, and I want to thank my very good friend, John Ruffin, for his kind introductions. And, John, I thank you for the outstanding job that you do every day. It is not enough to have a job. It must be a mission. And John, Dr. John Ruffin, gets up every day determined to make life better for the people of these United States. Would you please give him a round of applause? On the floor of the House, everybody gets up and says, my best friend, or my good friend. Well, I just want you to know I do not say those words lightly, for I have so much respect for Dr. Ruffin. And I want to thank you also for the National Institutes of Health and the National Center on Minority Health and Health Disparities for coming together around this critically important topic of addressing health disparities. I can think of no better time for us to be having this conversation. As you know, our country is on the brink of change. We are moving into the era of change. President-elect Barack Obama and his newly appointed Secretary of Health and Human Services, former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, are committed to creating universal health care in this country. But a lot of the people in this room started that conversation, and I came by here to say thank you. As we speak, the President-elect's transition team has mobilized his historic grassroots network to hold a series of healthcare community discussions between now and December 31st. These are small local gatherings in which everyday Americans are getting together with their neighbors to share thoughts and ideas about reforming healthcare. With 47 million Americans lacking healthcare, and on any given day, 68 million lacking healthcare, and millions more underinsured, I know that the American people have a few ideas about what we ought to be doing to reform our broken healthcare system. Given that more than half of America's uninsured population is comprised of people of color, let me say that again. Given that more than half of America's uninsured population is comprised of people of color, I can guarantee you that the topic of healthcare disparities will rise as part of this conversation. I know that I do not have to tell you that according to Healthy People 2010, heart disease death rates are more than 40% higher in the African American than for whites. The death rate for all cancers is 30% higher for African Americans than for whites. For prostate cancer, it is more than double that for whites. And the death rate from HIV/AIDS for African Americans is more than 7 times that of whites. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the figures for Hispanics are no better. Compared to whites, Hispanics of all races have an 18% higher death rate from stroke, 62% death rate from chronic liver disease and cirrhosis, 41% higher death rate from diabetes, and 168% higher death rate from HIV/AIDS. The Indian Health Service reports a similar story for the Indians and the Alaskan Natives. Compared to other Americans, these groups have a 750% higher death rate from tuberculosis, a 550% higher death rate from alcoholism, and a 190% death rate from diabetes. And while the health status of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders may appear better on paper than other people of color, our current data collection methods aren't very good to tell the real story about what's happening to certain subgroups within these populations. Did you notice that there were some commonalities in the statistics I cited? You may have heard diabetes, heart disease, and stroke mentioned over and over again. These chronic diseases are related to our nation's skyrocketing obesity epidemic. Unfortunately, nearly 25 million of our nation's children and adolescents are obese or at risk for obesity. African American, Native American, Latino, and Pacific Islander children are disproportionately affected. If we do not reverse this trend, ladies and gentlemen, the health disparities and rates of premature death experienced by our communities are likely to get worse. I know that I do not have to list these statistics for you because you, like me, live with them every day. You, like me, get up every day trying to address them. But can I let you on a little secret? It is not an accident that people of color across the nation are disproportionately suffering with and dying from largely preventable chronic diseases. We now know there are social determinants of health, such as poverty, inadequate education, poor housing, and toxic environments that contribute greatly to the health disparities that people of color face. We also know from the Institute of Medicine's Path-Breaking Unequal Treatment Report that social perceptions
and attitudes also make a difference. When I think about health disparities or the findings from unequal treatment, I'm reminded of my own grandfather, who I never had a chance to know, Dr. Sullivan. My father tells a story that when he was a little boy in South Carolina, my grandfather was preaching, and he fell sick in the pulpit. And they put him in a wagon, and they took him to the house. And when he got to the house, they called the doctors to come in to see him. Shortly thereafter, a young doctor and an older doctor arrived. And when they arrived, they went in and gave my grandfather a pill, patted him on the head, as my father tells the story. Keep in mind, my father was only 8. And then my father remembered these words that literally went with him until the day he died. The older white doctor said to the younger white doctor, "We've got to go now." And the younger white doctor said, "But doc, we've got to get this man to a hospital. I think we can save him, and if we don't, I think he may die." And my father remembered the words, "Don't worry about him. He's only a nigger." And that night, my grandfather died. And my father, even 3 days before his death, he was still talking about that story at 73 years old. Because he had been deprived of his father, but his children were also deprived of their grandfather. And I just want you to understand that this is bigger than the present population. I've often said that our children are the living messages we send to a future we will never see. There is no price that you can put on a person living long enough to share their secrets, their inspiration, their words of wisdom with their offspring. You can't put a price on that. And so my grandfather died for no other reason than bigotry and hate. We've come a long way since those days, but we still have much further to go. In just 2 generations, we have not only integrated the healthcare system, we have educated a whole generation of doctors, nurses, researchers, and other health professionals who are people of color. But as the statistics show, the doctor's office door remains shut for far too many of us. The overt racism that my grandfather faced may no longer be the norm, but the systemic challenges that face our communities are preventing us from getting the equality health care we need. For me, our nation's health care crisis has a face and a name. And I was so glad that Dr. Ruffin mentioned Diamante Driver. Diamante Driver was a little boy who died on February 25th, 2007, at the age of 12 years old. Diamante was a little boy who could not find a doctor to treat the diseased tooth that he had. It would have cost $80 to fill that tooth, and Diamante would still be with us. But his mother went to some 40-some doctors, dentists, couldn't find anybody to help that little boy. And Diamante died. And I said a moment ago that our children are the living messages that we send to a future we will never see. But it is tragic, and it should be an embarrassment to this nation for any child to die because he could not get $80 worth of tooth repair. There's something wrong with that picture. And there's also something wrong with the picture when we have a president that would veto the S-CHIP bill twice. You got to hear me now. I hope I'm not stepping on anybody's toes, but if you got them out, I'm going to step on them. But yet and still, spend $10.5 billion a month to tear down a country, then build it back up. Build health care systems for them. But little Diamante Driver will never celebrate another birthday. Diamante Driver will never celebrate another Christmas. Diamante Driver is dead in the United States of America, in this county that you sit in now. And so we got to do better than that. The CDC reports that dental decay is the single most common chronic disease in children. Thousands of Diamante Drivers are walking around every day, unable to concentrate in school, chew their supper, or fall asleep at night because their mouths are throbbing in pain. And the reason why I have such passion about this, Dr. Sullivan, is when I was a little boy living in the inner city of Baltimore, we thought that tooth decay and your tooth hurting was just a part of life. Everybody had some oral gel. I mean, that was like as common as aspirin. Everybody had some turpentine. Everybody had the cotton balls. And everybody had the toothpicks. I know some of you all don't get that, but let me explain it to you. When your tooth started hurting, you put some oral gel on it. And if it did not stop hurting, you took your cotton ball, put it on a toothpick, stick it in the turpentine, and stick the cotton in your tooth. And if that didn't work, you were just in pain. Ladies and gentlemen, this should not be the case in the wealthiest country in the world. And yet it is. I do not agree with President Bush on many things. But I think he is on to something when he talks about the soft bigotry of low expectations. Far too long, we have been mired in a culture of mediocrity in this country, where we should have strived for excellence. We have settled for second rate instead. The evidence of this damaging manner of thinking is present all around us. You need to look no further than the meltdown on Wall Street and its subsequent fallout. In investigating where the first $350 billion installment on the federal bailout went, the Oversight and Government Reform Committee uncovered gross negligence on the part of some of the firms that were receiving the funds. We found documentation, for example, that one of the biggest beneficiaries, the insurance giant AIG, spent more than $400,000 of your tax money on an executive retreat just weeks after we bailed them out. Hello? Oh, they were partying it up. They got the first installment. The next day, they were partying. Hey, party over here. They were spending about 150 people spent $23,000 in the spa getting their manicures, pedicures, massages, and facials. Spent thousands of dollars at the bar. $1,600 a night per room. I hope they're not charging y'all that, yeah. And what I'm saying to you at these folks don't get it. And their level of negligence is difficult to comprehend. I don't mean to imply, however, that I'm overly pessimistic about the situation that confronts us. As I noted when I began this speech, the American people has spoken, and they have handed us a mandate for change. Thanks to President-elect Obama's record-breaking organizing throughout the campaign, we have a massive network of everyday Americans ready and willing to roll up their sleeves and get to work. I traveled all throughout this country for Senator Barack Obama. I wasn't a latecomer. I tell a little story about how when the senator, who's been a friend of mine for years, called me in January, Dr. Piquet, called me in January 2007, said, Congressman, I need your help. I said, okay. I said, what do you need me for? He said, I need you to run my campaign in Maryland. I said, okay. Campaign for what? I knew he wasn't running against me. He said, for president. I said, president of what? And you know how he says that? Of the United States of America. He said, of the United States of America. I said, oh. But there was a determination. We started with one volunteer in Maryland. I called my friends together. And I said, look, we're going to have a meeting because Barack Obama is running for president. And they said, oh. So I called the meeting at the library. Said, you all meet me at 5 o'clock. Because Barack, now listen to this confidence. I said, Barack told me to hold a meeting because when he wins, he wants everything to be in order. He said, so make sure you take notes. It's a true story. So I go to the library, and I want to make it official. So I bring my tape recorder, and I said, we are all gathered here. Oh, 6 o'clock came, nobody showed up. 7 o'clock, nobody showed up. I said, Barack said, do this right, so let me do it. I said, we all gathered here at the library on Cathedral Street. And we are here to form Marylanders for Barack Obama. I nominate Elijah Cummings, second that nomination. We'll make him president. So it got good to me. It got good. I said, all right, we need a vice president. Who will volunteer? Elijah Cummings again. I ended up making myself president, vice president, treasurer, and secretary. But to show the power of an idea, we went in 1 year from one volunteer to 10,000 volunteers. To 10,000. Why? Because people were tired of what they were going through. And every speech that I made on behalf of Barack, I told them, if we do nothing else, if you do nothing else, tell people they have to go out and vote to improve our health care system. And so, and thanks to the last election, we now have two Democratic chambers of Congress and a Democratic administration firmly committed to the principles of universal health care and eliminating disparities. We have the vision. We have the political will, and now we need a roadmap. We know that in the coming health care reform effort, there are certain items that must be addressed in order to eliminate health disparities. Some of these items include the following: providing people with access to quality, affordable health care regardless of their employment status, employer type, income, or education level. Institutionalizing measures that improve upon and measure the quality of care provided people of color. Eliminating discriminatory treatment in our healthcare system through cultural competency training, enhanced language access, and stronger civil rights enforcement. And I'm so glad that my good friend Eric Holder is going to be in the Justice Department. Now, you need to clap on that one. Developing a physician payment structure that includes strong incentives for providing quality care and preventive health care, and improving data collection measures by standardizing the collection of racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic data, as well as methods for disaggregating data by racial and ethnic subgroups. We also need to adopt broader policy measures that close the education, housing, environmental, and income disparities that contribute to health disparities. Ladies and gentlemen, this is where all of you come in. You are the scientists in this puzzle. You are the ones, you are the ones who will provide both the clinicians on the ground and the politicians here in Washington, D.C., with the information we need to address the devastating reality that we face. Never, ever, never, ever underestimate the power of the work that you do. The National Center on Minority Health and Health Disparities was created by an act of Congress, but it was given life by individuals like Dr. Refn and all of you, who have given their blood, their sweat, and tears to make it a success. And Dr. Refn, I want to commit to you, and I make this commitment to you today and to this group. Henry Waxman is a wonderful friend of mine, and I helped Henry, as a matter of fact, I gave his nominating speech when he became the chairman of our Commerce Committee that deals, of course, as you all know, with health. And I said, Henry, one of the things that we've got to do is make Dr. Ruffin's shop a permanent shop and make it something that all of us will be proud of. And I'm letting you know, listen to me, I am promising you here on C-SPAN that I will do everything in my power to address that issue, because I am tired of going to funerals of people who died too early. I'm tired of seeing people who don't get the kind of health care they need, like my father, who died early because of a poor diagnosis. I'm tired of going to places like Morgan State University, where I was a few days ago, and asking the question of students, how many people in this room of 150 know of relatives or friends who have died within the last 2 years that you know, if they had gotten the proper treatment and had been treated right, would not have died, and when 90% of the kids raise their hand. There is something wrong with that picture, and we can do better. And that is what Barack Obama is saying. This is the United States of America. We can do better, and we must do better. I think that we can agree that 2 years from our target, we are still very far from reaching our goal with the Healthy People 2010 initiative. But the people who can make this happen are in this room. I want you to look to your left. Come on, look at them. Look at them. Look to your right. Look behind you. You're the ones that can make it happen. Give yourself a hand. I want to get you pumped up. That is why I'm challenging each of you to do your part to make this dream a reality. We can eliminate health disparities, and we can do it in our time. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a critical moment. This is a critical moment. At 57 years old, I don't know whether these 8 years, I'll ever see it 8 years like this, where we've got a president who's got it right, got a Congress who's got it right. But we must be the foot soldiers, and we must fight this fight, because this is so much bigger than us. This is about generations yet unborn. I will close by reading you a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, who said, "Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane." I want to just close this out, just come full circle, about my father. Yesterday, it's so ironic, Dr. Ruffin, it's so ironic that I am speaking here today. Because yesterday, I was speaking before a group of Maryland hospital administrators. And I was talking to them about diversity in hiring and with regard to contracts and things of that nature. But my spirit, you know how your spirit just comes over you? And my spirit said, "Tell them about your daddy. And remember, my father saw his father die when he probably could have been saved." So I started telling my daddy's story. I said, "My daddy was out here in Maryland. I won't name the hospital. But he was giving a speech, sermon. He was a preacher, just like his father. And I said, he gave the speech and then he fell ill." This is what I'm telling him yesterday. And I said, "When he fell ill 7 years ago, they took him to the hospital. I was in church. I got a call. Your daddy is unconscious. Get out here quick. You got to get here." And on my way there, my spirit told me he was dead. When I walked in the waiting room of this Maryland hospital, I saw my mother wailing. And I went to the desk and I said, "I need to see my daddy. I just want to see my daddy." And the doctor, the people in the desk said, "Well, he's dead. You go on over there and sit, boy." Not boy, but you go. That's how it came off. I went to console my mother. And somebody walked in the door and said, "Hey, Congressman, what you doing here?" I said, "My father just died." I said, "My father just died. My best friend just died." And when the people behind the desk heard the word congressman, they jumped up. And I went in and I saw my father. And you know something about this kind of thing? They had a tube in his mouth. His body was still warm. And I said, "Daddy, I'm sorry. I know you've been through a lot. And you saw your father die. And I don't know how you were treated, brother. But I hope you didn't experience what your daddy experienced. And I didn't know it. But the administrator of the hospital was sitting right in front of me. And I saw him dabbing. And I'm wondering, what's up?" And he said, I'm the administrator. This happened yesterday. He said, "And I want to apologize. I want to apologize to you and your mother." I said, "I accept your apology. But until they heard the word congressman, they didn't realize that he was more than a black man. He was my daddy. He was a preacher. He was a man that raised his 7 children. He was a man that never got a headline in the Washington Post. Never mentioned on WTOP. Never on Brian Williams' show. But he was the greatest black man I knew because he was my daddy. And so as I close, there's so much value in that. And I told you a little bit earlier, it's not about just healthcare. It's about the presence of people in your life. And as Christmas time is here, I leave you with my last little story. We had a tough Christmas one Christmas. Oh, it was a tough Christmas. Oh, it was tough. Daddy didn't have no money. He had been laid off. And Dr. Ruffin, we came down to the Christmas tree looking for the skates and the bike. And all we had was our daddy. But I want to beg you to implant this, his words, in the DNA of every cell of your brain. He sat there under the Christmas tree. He said, this is a rough Christmas. Daddy didn't have any money. Daddy didn't even have money. This is what he's saying to us. Daddy didn't even have money to buy toothbrushes. But he sat there under the tree with his undershirt on and his jeans, barefoot. He said, but I want you may not understand this today, but you'll understand it. I was only 8. He said, my presence in your life is presence enough. My presence in your life is presence enough. So when I went out trying to explain it to the other kids, they said, what? But he was my greatest gift. And so when you go out there, remember Robert Cummings, a strong brother, a brother who gave all, raised his kids, and produced a United States congressman. May God bless.
Stand with me for a second. Ladies and gentlemen, if you agree with me, then short by your applause, I would say that we have a foot soldier in the Congress of the United States. No question about it. I'm going to get out of here. The only other thing that I want to say before we get the congressman out, because he has other places to go, is that he mentioned these forums that the president has called for, President Obama has called for. I wanted him to know that on tomorrow morning, we will be conducting a town hall meeting, and in that town hall meeting, we will be asking these professionals to give us their views, and hopefully those recommendations, we will make sure that Secretary Daschle will get those recommendations so that they could feel the pulse of this group. So we want to make sure that all of you are there to participate in this event. Thank you so much, Congressman. You want to make sure.